The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by 5 local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Paul Trinka. He's just written a book about Brian Jones. It's called The Making of the Rolling Stones. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Vic. How are you doing?
Wonderful. You know, Paul, I always wondered about Brian Jones, and having read your book, I'm not wondering about him anymore. Wow, what a story. What made you decide to write about him?
I think almost exactly that reason. I knew it was a great yarn. I'd known a fair amount about Brian Jones over the years because we commissioned a few stories from him at Mojo. And then I'd always found the atmosphere around the Stones intriguing and strange. And I always felt there's a lot more to the Stones story, you know, than is out there in the books. Because, you know, with a couple of honorable exceptions, the books on them are just not very well sourced. And then I guess another spur was Keith's book, which was just so often plain wrong, you know. Bless him. You know, Keith was kind of a mate, but, you know, he couldn't even remember who played drums on the first gig. And he kind of attempted so consistently to erase Brian's contributions and importance that it, for me, it had the opposite effect. I just thought, no, this guy, you know, Brian is even more important than I thought, because they wouldn't expend so much energy trying to revise history otherwise.
In this book, we really get the impression that if it wasn't for Brian Jones, there wouldn't have been any Rolling Stones.
No, put simply, there wouldn't. You know, he put the ads in. He recruited the band members. They were hand-picked. Even the guys, there was one guy, Dick Taylor, the first bassist, who Mick and Keith knew. But it was Brian who invited him into the band, persuaded him to move from drums or guitar onto bass, went to the shop with him to help choose a bass guitar. So Brian Jones looked over every aspect of the music and the sets. And most importantly, he was the one with the vision, the one who actually said, we need to have a blues band because this music is going to be huge. They didn't think that. They thought it was hobby music. That's why other people turned him down, because they thought the music just wasn't going to be that big. It was Brian who had the vision to see this could be bigger than, you know, than club music or student music. And it's Brian who really is responsible for selling the blues and people like Howlin' Wolf back to America.
My guest is Paul Trinka. His book is Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones. Just came out in paperback. And you track the tragic trajectory of a man who came out of nowhere, became a huge rock and roll star, lived the rock and roll life, and just petered and put it all away and was dead within about 6 years.
Yes, I guess he was a prototype in many terrible respects, as in many great respects, because, you know, people just didn't know what was going to happen. They were flying without radar, and you know, whoever thought that this music he loved, you know, the idea that it could be huge was incredible to so many people. Then so many others thought the music would all be over in a couple of years, you know, so it was that ultimate, you know, live fast, die young mentality. And they were exposed to all these new experiences, and he was, you know, he indulged in every excess, both sorts of sexual and in terms of drugs as well, and in terms of behavior. You know, it was this incredible pressure cooker, and he couldn't make it out alive. But, you know, perhaps who could in those circumstances?
I was just a kid when the Stones came out, and I liked them because, number one, girls liked the Beatles, and I liked the Stones because they were bad. They were bad boys, and you show us how Brian Jones really created this image for them.
Yeah, more than anybody else. I mean, it's always said that this was the creation of Andrew Oldham. Yeah, I have several key people, including Harold Pendleton, who managed the Marquee and dealt with them a lot in the early days. He was the one who he didn't like Brian Jones. He described him as an evil genius. You know, he thought he had a kind of devilish streak to him, but he was the evil genius who came up with that image, and it was right there, that aggression, right from the beginning. So forget anything you've heard about this being a creation. It was Brian who'd get in people's faces, sneer at them, do all this stuff that was unthinkable, and that was right there from the start.
And it was Brian who was passionate about the blues and about R&B, and he loved this music, and he really transmitted his passion to the rest of the band.
Yeah, they wouldn't have done it as a full-time thing if Brian hadn't talked them into it. This was really the ultimate gift of his to the world. He felt very profoundly that this was something important. And this applied to music later on as well. It certainly applied to all the world music, the Moroccan music that he turned people onto, because he was also a real pioneer in world music records, has been credited by, you know, some of the titans of the industry as such. But yes, to have that vision when nobody else had it, and also to unlock those secrets, because, you know, there are so many elements of tunings, how you'd play the blues that are easy to discover now, or how you play harmonica that are easy to discover now. And Brian was the first, because he'd look into it obsessively, trying to work out how to get that sound. And he was the first one. So, you know, he opened the doors and others followed through.
You show us how, by the time he was in his mid-teens, he had become a very handsome, sort of a charismatic guy and a Lothario, and the women loved him. And this is a guy who was never married, but he certainly had a lot of children.
Yes, I mean, this was the one disturbing aspect of the story, because there's a backdrop of misogyny right through all of this. And that applies to many people, not just Brian. But, you know, Brian fathered a lot of kids, at least half a dozen. I found one extra one. An extra child that he'd fathered at grammar school. And he was somebody who acted without any care of the consequences. And that applied to himself, and it applied to other people as well. So there was just some part of working out what would happen that, you know, that just didn't apply to him. And so you look at something like Mick Jagger. Mick was very careful. You know, that can often mean that you can't make great art. Brian pushed Mick into making great art, but there were a lot of consequences. And reading some of those stories, there's a woman called Dawn Malloy who had to give her child up for adoption. You know, she was there in a kind of Catholic orphanage, had to give her child away. There's a lot of pain and suffering behind that story. And, you know, Brian isn't necessarily responsible for all of it, but he's a part of it. So there's many dark sides to this story as well.
Paul Trinka joins us. His book, Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, just came out in paperback. And Paul's doing his best to write this somewhat forgotten musical visionary back into the Rolling Stones history. He's sort of been airbrushed out, hasn't he?
Well, I think it has been a concerted effort to airbrush him out. And that's not unusual with pop stars. I think what is unique is that he's somewhat outnumbered. But, you know, I'm confident that the truth will out in the end. There aren't that many, you know, detailed stories of the Stones. And, you know, there are many stories floating around. But what I've tried to do is, rather than have one person make an allegation, which might or might mean anything, is to back it up with a lot of people. So, you know, in terms of how Brian contributed to the songs, you know, I don't have one person. I've got lots of people telling us exactly what he contributed. We even have the Stones accountant pointing out how he used to say to Brian, don't let other people take the credit for your work. You're giving millions of dollars away. So it's, you know, it's a huge story. And so I've tried to do it justice. I interviewed well over 130 people. And I believe it will, along with everything else, it'll take its part in terms of just changing perceptions. But obviously, I realize it's a big ask. It's a big job.
These guys were literally starving to death. And then within a year or two, suddenly they were rolling in cash, driving these fancy cars, traveling the world. It happened so fast. And you have all these extensive interviews that you've used to create this book. And it's a really impressive list. Did you actually get to talk to Keith Richards? Was he cooperative with you?
I'd interviewed Keith a lot of times over the years, and I'd spoken to him quite a lot about Brian over the years, and I favoured those over re-interviewing him because he was off his guard when he chatted to me.
Okay.
And then, you know, at the same time, I got a lot of other people like Andrew Oldham, who, you know, doesn't necessarily come across badly, but I'm pointing out the errors in, you know, his own account and, you know, how things happen differently. And I was lucky, really, to be able to get to so many people, you know, people like Marianne Faithfull. And I guess a lot of that just comes from being known, you know, and working on Mojo over the years. I've been around, so, you know, I can get to people straight away and start shaping the story and then being able to change the story, you know, because that's the other thing. You never know what you think until it's all done, until you've spoken to every last person. And as a writer, you're going on an emotional journey in the same way as your readers are. So I certainly didn't approach this with any preconceptions. I just went where the story took me, and I feel quite blessed to have undergone, you know, lived through a story like this, because it's not just about Brian. It's about an era. It's about a generation. It's about a really important decade that is still important today, and has left a huge imprint on today's society. And Brian is a crucial part of that, and this is a chance to put him back at the center of the story and also credit other people who were forgotten. There's a guy called Jack Nietzsche who was the arranger on a lot of those records. You never see him mentioned in the other Stones books. You know, people like Eric Easton, who was the original manager, never credited. So, you know, I really tried to put it on the record and do it in full. And, you know, Mick and Keith are amazing songwriters, and I have a lot of personal affection for Keith in particular. But the band, you know, to have the story just revolving around that couple isn't even a part of the story.
Paul, you show us the rise of Brian Jones with the Rolling Stones, and the Stones continue to rise, but then Brian begins to fall, and you show us these crucial things that happened that really tore him apart. The trip to Morocco was one. Another was the drug bus. Wow, this poor guy. You really feel sorry for him, except that he doesn't seem like a very nice guy sometimes.
He was an unreliable guy. He was a very sensitive guy. So in some ways, many people around liked him more than they did the other Stones. He'd reach out to people, so he'd form so many partnerships and bring people in, but he was unreliable. And we have these friends, don't we, where they tell us they're going to do these things for us and we can't rely on them. And that, you know, is infuriating, and one can understand the, you know, the hatred that might inspire. Yeah, in another sense, in Keith's book, you'll hear that, you know, that Brian was quite a violent character. So it's always, you know, that seems to have been folded into the whole story of him. And an element of that is absolutely true. And yet, in another sense, he was just like everybody else. They were all a very violent bunch. It was a violent time. They were young kids. They were at each other's throats. They were nicking each other's girlfriends. They were nasty a lot of the time. And in a way, that's what gives the music this amazing, dark energy. But yes, I spent a lot of time wrestling with almost every aspect of it, trying to tell the story and be fair and not make a judgment and leave the reader to make their own judgment.
You also reveal his impact on particular Stones tracks that we've all heard, that we know, and we see how their sound changed after Brian's impact was gone. And when I think of Brian Jones, I think of songs like Ruby Tuesday.
Well, that's a song that will always be special to me. And, you know, that really is, if it's anybody's song, it is Brian Jones' song. You know, it started from a tune he was playing. Even the arrangement is very him, you know, because he was interested in all this John Dowland Renaissance English music. So when you hear that sensibility, that's all Brian. And then he was interested in Skip James, this Bentonia bluesman who used to play with a particular minor scale. And that's Brian. And then the song, that sense of loss, is very much about Brian. But it's Marianne Faithfull who said, you know, he'd really come up with that song because he thought that somehow if he did something very beautiful and perfect, it'd put him back at the center of things, and Mick and Keith would love or like him again. And, of course, it made no difference. That's terribly sad.
And when we see the way that they mistreated him and the way that they didn't respect him, it's just appalling, particularly things like having him come in to lay down a track and not having the mic on.
Yeah, it is appalling. Absolutely. So it is there. I'd also point out that, you know, that's what guys in bands do. That's what happens, because they're, you know, they're operating outside their sort of design specs. You know, they're all on the edge. They don't really know what's going to happen. They're conscious everything can fall apart any minute, and it's impossible to exaggerate the hatred you can sometimes feel in a band for somebody sort of pissing you around when you're trying to get an idea over. But at the same time, it's not necessarily unforgivable. What is unforgivable is to not acknowledge that when we're mature adults and to credit somebody for what he did, just to talk honestly about it. And there are some people in music who talk, or in whatever industry, you know, who'll talk honestly about the past. And I'm sorry that Keith missed an opportunity to do that in his book, because it's a heck of a story. You know, it really does, as we said, still affects us today. And I think we, you know, as a psychological exercise, it's an incredible one. And I guess Keith's view is, hey, that's what happens. You know, it's like people died at Altamont. Hey, that's what happens. There's a certain callousness there in Keith's book. But I care about the people who were left behind. You know, I care about the bluesmen that the Stones tapped into, you know, who got left behind. And I think we have a duty to care about the people who made a difference, not just the ones who made the headlines.
Paul Trinka joins us on the program. His book, Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, just came out in paperback. And, Paul, I saw the Stones, I think it was summer of 72. Mick Taylor was already in the band. And they put on one heck of a show, and they were so tight. And I've seen them later, and I didn't like them as much. You keep talking about Keith Richards' memoir, which I really enjoy, but I think the last 25 to 30% of the book I didn't need to read, because we start getting into all those albums that, frankly, a lot of us just don't care about.
Well, it's hard. I mean, it's a strange thing. You know, when I saw the band on the 50th anniversary tour, maybe beginning of 2013, frankly, they were awful. They played fairly badly, but there was no feeling of community or the sort of no interaction. Mick and Keith only looked at each other for a few seconds as they walked down a ramp into the audience at one point. Otherwise, there was no eye contact. They'd invited Bill along, and Bill was just studiously ignored. And, you know, he told me later how they didn't even let him use his own bass amp. They didn't even tell him what songs they were going to play. So it was just an exercise in somehow messing them around and asserting power. And to me, that debases a lot of the nobility of the music. And, you know, I find that a sad thing. Equally, I've seen Keith Richards play solo dates that were absolutely stunning. And personally, you know, I love the Stones. I don't see any reason to watch them be a kind of theme park version of themselves. I'd rather see Keith Richards do a good solo gig than keep perpetuating this affair. If they were going to do it well, then great. But I personally think they are just going through the motions, and it somehow spoils retrospectively the great stuff they've done. Because I've come back from gigs twice thinking, you know, you didn't really care very much. But there we go. I have high standards. So I work for Mojo, and they always used to call us rock snobs. So maybe there's no getting away from being a rock snob.
You just mentioned Bill. Of course, you're referring to Bill Wyman, the Stones bassist, who left the band, what was it, in 92?
Yes, I think it was, 92 or 93, yes.
We had him on this program back in the late 90s. I loved him. And he stood up for Brian, didn't he?
He still does. I mean, it's Bill who actually says how Keith's description of Brian in his book is disgusting, and how, you know, much of it is fantasy. And it's interesting that, you know, recently Bill spoke up about Mick and Keith being the founders of stones, a claim that's been repeated in many places, including on Dartford train station. And it's Bill that said, no, this is wrong. And what I found very interesting is, you know, Keith reacted and said, well, Bill, you weren't the founder, were you? And he completely overlooked. Bill wasn't saying he was the founder of the stones. He was saying Brian was. So, and I think that was a conscious error, just a smokescreen. And, but I guess everybody is insecure. If Keith and Mick were a bit more secure, it wouldn't hurt them at all to say, well, look, this guy is the one who founded the band, because they own the band, it's theirs. You know, that's not taken away from what they've done and everything they've achieved, because, you know, they are terrific songwriters and terrific musicians. But, you know, for the verdict of history would be kinder if people were a little more honest, I think.
One gets the feeling, reading some of the old material, that the main reason they asked Bill to be in the band was because he had really good equipment already.
Yeah, it was quite a lot of that. He had a good Vox, a big Vox amplifier, and two of them could plug into it. And he was, but also he was a good bassist.
Uh-huh.
He worked really well with Charlie. And they sort of arrived at the same time. And when something works, it works. You know, they had tried another rhythm section, including Rick Brown and Carlo Little, and I interviewed Rick, and also, you know, Bill was up for it, you know, because this was a big risk. There weren't that many bands around, and to commit everything to it was a big step. You know, other people might have wanted to play, you know, show tunes or whatever, so to bet everything on this throw of blues music was quite extreme. It was very easy to make that decision 6 months later, but it was much harder to do it, you know, in 62 or the very beginning of 63. So to that extent, you know, that's what gave the Stones their edge. They were there first, and they went further than anyone else. And, you know, I still think their early take on blues on that first album is fantastic. It's hard to say necessarily that's been bettered by any white blues bands, really.
My guest is Paul Trinka. His book is Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones. When I talked to Bill, he was staying in a hotel in Memphis, and I called him, and he kept doing his bass lines on the phone. He would do vocal imitations of his bass lines, and it was just priceless.
How wonderful. Yeah, I mean, Bill's often overlooked. He's a very good bassist, actually, and his bass line, you know, he's very distinctive as well. And, Under My Thumb in particular has got a fantastic bass line, as well as Brian's inspirational marimba. They were, you know, what can we say? They were a great band, and, you know, great bands are more than the sum of their parts. You know, to just strip it down to two people makes it into a cartoon version, and those early records are really tough and wonderful, and they still sound great. It's a shame, of course, that, you know, they're all owned by Alan Klein's family, and we can't really get the great versions of them today. You know, it's one of many sort of frustrations of this period, and just another sort of symptom of kind of what a mess it was, and how people were bluffing their way through the whole business.
For those of us who are fans of this era, and I know a lot of people are, there are some amazing interactions in this story between various people that we all know. The Beatles are in here, Donovan, and a lot of people who were coming up at the same time. And one guy who you apparently interviewed a lot, we've also had him on this program, was a guy named Eric Burdon. What's great stories he had to tell. Wow.
Yeah, Eric is great. I mean, he was almost a childhood a hero of mine. I've always loved his singing, and he's, you know, he has this real passion and really cares about it. It was there at the time, you know, so for him, he picked on Brian as somebody who was really, really important. You know, people like Ginger Baker would say the same. You know, for the people who were there, they knew who the movers and shakers were who were pushing the music forward. So they might find it strange to have, you know, history so distorted in retrospect, but Eric's was great because he also talked about Brian in a very sort of visionary way, you know, of what he was like as a presence, how he was an amazing presence, but also there was something kind of quite dark about him. He was very taken with, you know, the way that Brian took the music to the edge, you know, with things like Paint It Black. He brought in this new tonality, and then he went out to Morocco, to Djajouka, in the middle of nowhere, you know, staying in a place with no toilets, no roads or anything, to tape a bunch of master musicians recording what was kind of trance music. You know, and Eric respected somebody who was out there, and Brian doesn't really get respect for that because, sadly, people tend to fixate on, you know, his death, but it wasn't his death that changed the world. It was really the musical vision that left a completely transformed musical landscape to this day, I think.
And for those of us who remember and those who didn't know, Brian was 27 when he drowned in his swimming pool, and there were a lot of theories about that, and you go over all of them as you close the book.
Yeah. I mean, I was fairly open-minded. I'd seen some of the murder theories early on and wasn't necessarily convinced that the official verdict that he drowned by misadventure was rushed. You know, there were obvious mistakes. It was actually quite offensive how they dealt with his death. And yet, when you look at a lot of the murder conspiracy theories, I find those sketchier than the official version. And yeah, there are many accounts where it's obvious that people are misrepresenting interviews or telling outright lies in order to construct a theory. And I believe that the simplest version is the simplest scenario is the most likely one. You know, that would change if we had any new evidence, but ultimately for him to have been murdered in many of the scenarios that are laid out, the murderers would have had to have been supermen, you know, and ultimately his murder wouldn't have really benefited anybody. So I think the most likely scenario is the official one, that sadly, you know, he was not in great condition. The people who were near him at the end, you know, felt very saddened. They felt he wasn't necessarily that long for this world. He wasn't in a great state. He was a broken man. He'd been broken by being ousted from the band that he loved, and he was also broken by the relentless persecution by the authorities, by the British police. He was also hugely damaged because he changed from illegal drugs to prescription drugs. It had a terrible effect on his musical ability. So, no, he was sadly a very broken man. I mean, you know, today with sort of much better therapy, when we have more understanding, maybe people basically could have rescued him. But sadly, you know, that there was nobody like that looking out for him.
Well, Paul, we really appreciate your time.
Well, absolute pleasure. I can only thank you. It's wonderful, Vic. Thank you.
You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Paul Trinka. The book is Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones.
She would never say where she came from. Yesterday don't matter if it's gone. While the sun is bright, or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and goes. Question why she needs to be so free. She'll tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing